And it's Saturday, October 6th, 2012. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio. It's time now for Geek Speak. And that theme song by our own Al Luckow. It's Creative Commons, share and share alike. If you have a theme song you want us to play, please send it to us. We'll give it a shot. We'll take a listen and see if we want to share it to the Central Coast, California, and all you podcast listeners out there. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. So I am a software engineer and political junkie. Soon I will have Alex Lias, an information security analyst, on. I'm going to start off with a tech support scammer. Some of you may come across this very soon. It's called, I'm calling you from Microsoft Tech Support, and there's an issue with your Windows installation. We've detected that you have a piece of malware, a virus or whatnot. So could you open up a connection so that I can connect up to your computer and diagnose this problem? Yeah, if you ever get that phone number, do not do what they say. This was actually covered by a group called Ars Technica, and they are a online magazine that specializes in tech. And it was really curious that they just had a report out about having scammers call like this. And then just as they were going to write up a story about it, someone actually called them. It was this fortuitous series of events that led them to actually see what exactly they were saying. They were saying, my computer's infested with viruses. Are you okay with me charging a credit card and I'll get this taken care of? As it turns out, this particular person was calling from India, but it could be from anywhere. And as a public service announcement for all those folks listening, I just wanted to let you know, Microsoft will never call you asking for this. Apple will never call you specifically asking for this information or telling you that you have a virus. It will never happen. So there doesn't have to be any angst about, is this for real or not? You can assume it's not and just move on with your day. Okay, and I have Devo playing apparently. Yeah, this is just a wonderful episode. I have Alex. The funny thing is Alex and I are going through Skype right now and I can see his face. And he's just laughing at me. Which, you know, is only fair. But at this point, I'm going to say hello, Alex.
Hello, Alex. So am I actually on now?
Well, folks can actually hear you now.
Okay.
So what I'm going to do now is simply ask you to do your next news story.
All right, sure. Let's go over an article here where the coming internet video crash is upon us.
Wait, I'm sorry. Coming internet video crash?
Video crash. It's a little bit more of a hype headline off this article, but really what it's talking about is how the increase in our bandwidth usage is more or less what's kind of leading to a lot of the providers going and saying, you know, We're not going to be having unlimited bandwidth. We saw it with our cell phones. You know, unlimited bandwidth is pretty much gone for the most part. But you're also now starting to see it with home providers. So,
oh, sorry about that. I believe he'll have cut you off for just a second. Hold on just one second.
Sure.
You got nothing better to do, right? See, the thing is I cut him off before he can answer. It's really great. Now can we hear you?
I don't know.
There we go. That sounds much better.
All right. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
So anyway, where was I with before you had cut me off there?
We were talking about the coming video apocalypse because of the amount of bandwidth we are using.
Right. So really, the video crash is not really what we're going to be seeing as like the crash, like we see a crash of a computer. It really is just, what we're seeing is the end of unlimited bandwidth. We're not able to just kind of get everything we want and just keep pulling data down. We're now using high definition video that we're streaming. We're pulling a lot more data for the period of time that we're actually using it. So larger files in less time. And we see the wireless companies all put caps now. There's no really, I don't think anybody has a truly unlimited bandwidth anymore, at least not even advertised. And now you're starting to see it with the home providers, cable providers, and all that.
Yeah, I thought Sprint still did.
What's that?
I thought Sprint still did.
Sprint might. I don't expect that to last long. I mean, right. they're a 4G provider. It's just the math. I mean, if you're pulling down HD video across your link, you're saturating it. And if more and more people start doing that, their networks start getting saturated. And they need to start ramping it up. But I think the rate at which we are increasing our consumption, they're not keeping up with.
Right.
And
now,
so we're going to start seeing that limit.
Yeah. So this is something I do want to talk about as a general topic. Seeing as how many other countries have, 100 megabit per second coming to the home. There are some places that are aiming to roll out 1 gigabit per second. There are ISPs like SonicNet that are rolling out these high speeds up in the Silicon Valley. But at the same time, now we're talking about we're using up too much data, so we can't manage the video that's coming in there. Is it really a scarcity there, or is there infrastructure just not catching up in the U.S.?
I think largely it is infrastructure. I think, well, partially. But then again, I mean, while you may have really high links to your home in Europe, when I've been to Europe, I don't see people using the internet quite to the extent that we do. Not in the bulk. I mean, certainly there are people, but I don't see the mass of population that uses bandwidth like we do. I mean, like many things, we consume it a lot more than Europe does.
Right. At the same time, if you have a service like Netflix or Pandora, for example, although Pandora is nowhere near as much as the video streaming that might be out there, you're still going to have things that are geographically located. In other words, you can optimize those points that, for example, if I'm pulling from Netflix, I'm pulling from just over the hill.
Yeah, I understand, but your provider is still serving all that bandwidth. And in Europe, I don't see that level of use. I don't see that mass. I mean, sure, there are people, but I mean, how often? I mean, Pandora is not listened to on mass like it is here. I mean, not literally Pandora, but the equivalent. You're not seeing the Netflix media and video consumption occurring nearly in as much as it does here. We simply are using it a lot higher. And I think that plays a part of it. I do think it is partly that they're not keeping, the companies are not keeping up. There's optimizations that can occur, and I'm sure for the most part they're doing that. I just think it's a combination of our technology is not quite being kept up and we're consuming a lot more.
Right. You go to the net with the internet that you have. But with the network that you have. At the same time, I do wonder about the reason why I bring this up is because over the past few decades, we've been paying surcharges on internet connections, or past couple decades anyway. And those surcharges were apparently to go toward to increase capacity. And I guess I wonder about how well that's going. I mean, in fairness, my connection is something like 5 times faster than it was 10 years ago.
Oh, 5? Mine's way faster than even 5, but yeah.
Well, I'm getting 15 megabits now, and I believe I had a 3 megabit 10
years ago.
Oh, that's
true. Yeah, I guess it is about that. But yeah, it's definitely a lot faster, although I personally would love to have 100 megabit at home to my home or more. I mean, what I love about bandwidth, I mean, having switched up to be able to use the a wider band for a 5 gigahertz connection with my 802.11n, I'm actually able to get what about 110 megabits?
Okay, I think you lost the audience there. Like I did that with my fiber, with my 802.11n. Just to get people back on.
But basically, Wi-Fi is, even my own Wi-Fi has gotten a lot faster, to the point that it's now as fast as a lot of the wired connections for computers. And I love that. And it just is way better, nicer. I just wish my house line out to the internet was faster.
Right. I don't know. I'm still enamored of the idea of on the home network, the network hard drive is just as fast as a local hard drive. It's still almost there, but not quite.
Well, yeah, local hard drives are still going faster. But yeah, it's definitely getting there.
Yeah, I'm still looking forward to 100 megabits per second. And honestly, I would like to see more of a regional, like community-oriented net where you would be able to connect up to neighbors or things like that at a much faster speed. And then as you get further and further away, have it slow down, for example. So it would be awesome, for example, if Lyle and I could share a network at 100 megabits per second to be able to serve files out or share files or get database stuff working. you know, and then connect up to you at, you know, a mere, you know, 10 megabits per second, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, we could do local gaming again.
And it, as he says this, he has a gaming headset, the exact same model that he bought for me. Why? Because he wanted to do internet gaming. And I was like, I don't want to get one of those. Fine, here's your birthday. And thus we played Battlefield. What was Battlefield 2 or Battlefield 1942?
It was Battlefield 2, I think we were playing.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about online, since we're already on the topic. This is Geek Speak, after all. And talk a little bit about online shakedowns. And this is going into the area of fraud, and an area that would affect the typical consumer that is online. Because everyone has their ads they have online, and more you have places like Yelp and the like that are giving reviews for your business. And sometimes it can be reviews for your business where you don't even have a website. It's just, for example, Yelp, where Yelp gives you the phone number, the address, and that's it, with a whole bunch of reviews saying, hey, this place is great. I want to eat here more often. Well, it turns out there are a whole bunch of folks going out there that are putting up a whole bunch of negative reviews, then calling up the business and saying, oh, well, if you pay us, we can fix that. You know, negative reviews are not something you have to live with. We can go on there and we can, you know, fix that up for you so that your reviews are more positive and therefore you get more business. So the question is what to do about that. So do you have any ideas on that, Alex?
I don't know. I actually heard a story that Netflix was involved in that sort of thing. And not quite, maybe not creating negative posts, but where people, the rating for a lot of new businesses was low, and that Netflix was following up. I mean, this was a year ago, I think. I remember hearing that. I don't know if that's still occurring or if that was just merely businesses complaining and theorizing. I think personally that sucks. You know, Yelp needs to, if I said Netflix earlier, I meant Yelp. If Yelp needs to step up, they need to clean up their data. It's their, you know, they're the ones who want value out of their site. They're the ones who are seeing the value decline in their site because of this practice. People are going to stop using it if they can't rely on it.
Yes,
so they need to fix it.
Yes, that is true. At the same time, I guess I think of Yelp being such a not having that much in terms of staff. Like a lot of these internet businesses, they have relatively few people for the number of businesses and number of reviews and the like that are up there. So from a manual standpoint, that seems rather difficult to police. You can't exactly tell the business, yeah, we want you to be able to just have control over your own reviews, because then bad reviews that are legitimate won't go through.
Yeah, that won't work.
So how do you get that to scale? How do you get humans to scale? We've got the computers to scale. How do you get humans to scale?
Well,
and most of it is crowdsourcing, which is what Yelp is doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's that. You have, I mean, the community itself can could help clean itself up, but I mean, there's a number of ways they could look at it. They could help have their community help with it, which is what I do on my own site. You know, I've got a part of the community that helps me with as being moderators that kind of are more interested in that sort of cleanup activity, and then there's other users who can go through and identify when there's a problem. They notify the moderators of the issue. So it's kind of a community effort there. But on Yelp, I would think there'd be ways to identify mass postings like this. I mean, unless they're using botnets and you know, resources like that, which would technically be illegal resources, which then you could then push back and prosecute on. If they're just doing it from a local network, why doesn't Yelp just find ways to detect the posting pattern?
Well, the thing
is, it's not like people who are doing it have a lot of resources either.
Yes, except that we're talking about a distributed system, right?
Well, then you're talking about botnets.
Well, no, I mean a distributed system as in not everyone who is posting bad reviews on a particular website is the same perpetrator. That it's a pattern of behavior rather than a few bad apples, as it were. Well, it is a few bad apples in the grand scheme of things, but it's not just one
that
criminal
many
group.
People. I just can't imagine there's that many people who are doing it. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's a significant number, but relative to the overall percentage, I have a hard time seeing it be that huge. That's just, I mean, how much do we have any measurement on how prevalent this issue is?
Well, I personally don't, but if someone does have information, we'd love for you to call in. The number here is 800-655-5877 or local at area code 831-476-2800, and we would take your call, and we would love to hear about if you have any information on that topic, or if you just have a general question about computers, we are here to take your call. Rick Philman will be answering phones and getting that information from you.
So, but yeah, I mean, it's really, I think, with the whole, I mean, not to use a catchphrase, but with the whole Web 2.0 world, which is one of the definitions that I tend to appreciate more, is that Web 2.0 is a web world where the content is being contributed by the visitors. So the site itself is largely exists because of visitors. So things like Yelp and sites like that, the community sites out there, that's a whole different challenge. When your content comes from everywhere, you know, and your people who are using it, relying on it, come from everywhere, there are going to be challenges, and that's one of them, is how do you police it? And it really depends on your model. It really depends on your needs. Personally, I think there's ways to identify some pattern to reduce some of it, not all of it, but some of it. If it's just a few people, they should be pretty easy to catch. You know, if you see one person posting a bunch of negative reviews from their same IP address, that should be pretty easy to catch.
Right.
You know, if we're talking about individuals, they can't be that sophisticated. If they are, then this has got to be a bit more organized and it's a bit more complex.
Then what happens if, for example, someone goes through a mobile web browser? Different IP every single time, pretty much, if they're moving around.
Not every single time. But, yeah, I mean, it's...
It's a hard problem.
That would be a challenge.
And we're hopefully it's just a few bad apples. Now, speaking of bad apples, Alex...
nice little transition there, Miles. So iPhone 5, varying, you know, there's a lot of opinions out there about what people like, don't like, the what it has and doesn't have. But there's one thing, and something you had kind of noted on, not specifically this issue, but was the iPhone's camera. I remember we were talking about just features out there, and You were remarking on just the resolution of the camera versus some of the ones out there from Nokia,
mm-hmm.
and the quality it comes down, the low light levels it does because of that. Well, there's a bigger issue with the iPhone 5. It has a purple haze,
or purple halo. Yeah, whenever there's a bright light source. Yeah.
Exactly. To me, this looks a lot like chromatic aberration. In the world of photography, when you have an edge that is a really high contrast, say black to white, and it's really bright and really dark, you end up with an edge of color along that border. This really looks a lot like it. I don't know if that's actually the root cause to this. I was digging through to try and find out, you know, what is the actual technical reason for this occurring. And I have yet to be able to find that. some people say it's specifically related to the types of crystal they use in the lens that causes this sort of coloration when you hit that high contrast, which, again, sounds like chromatic aberration in a lot of lenses. There's ways to fix it, but I wonder what Apple's going to do about it, honestly.
Yeah, there was some conjecture that this has to do with their so-called sapphire lens cover on it.
Right, the sapphire crystal lens, yeah.
Yeah,
lens.
So would a purple come off, I guess? Yeah.
It depends. If it's not that the, you know, it's just, it's not tinting the whole image.
Right.
That. So
it's like when you hold up to a prism and you have the color splitting.
Right, kind of similar to that. And that's exactly what chromatic aberration is when you have that high contrast edge on a regular camera. If you look really closely when you have those edges, you'll see like a purplish edge on one, and then on another edge you might see yellowish, or sometimes it's kind of a cyan, but you see those sort of colors on the edges of your high contrast areas. And this is exactly what it is in a big extreme.
Hmm.
So, but it looks like it's, you know, related to that material that they're using for the lens cover.
Yeah, and by the way, just for folks out there, when they say it's a sapphire lens cover, yeah, that's aluminum. Just I don't want to like rain on anyone's parade, but you have that same type of sapphire on every single aluminum pot and pan you have in your house. It's aluminum oxide. That's what sapphire is. It ends up being this very hard, very clear substance. But that's me just like, you know, raining on someone's parade. In other news, GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by supported by CruiseIO's Velocity Internet and Phone Service. Velocity achieves download speeds of up to 40 megabits per second with nationwide phone service included. More information is at velocity.cruiseio.com or at 459-6301. You're listening to 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. You can follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. So, Alex.
Yes, Miles.
You don't happen to have any other news stories, do you? Oh, you don't have any listed. I guess it's up to me to talk about.
I also moved some stuff down below.
Oh, you did?
Yep.
Oh, I see how it is. You're messing
with me. I can go into another one here, also regarding phones, slightly different take.
Yes, absolutely.
Oracle and Nokia have struck a deal.
Wait, I'm sorry. Let's back up for a second. Oracle and Nokia. Oracle is a database company, an application server, and Nokia is a cell phone company.
Yes, they are. They've struck a deal. Apparently, Nokia is betting that that maps are going to be a significant factor. And so they teamed up with Oracle to kind of come up with their mapping their strategy. So they're expected to. Oracle is expected to add Nokia's mapping technology to its applications as well. Because Oracle itself also has applications that they develop. So it's something interesting to note is that you have this another phone company with the big gaffe of the iPhone that, you know, map was the biggest thing that they were talking about, you know, down with the iPhone for its bad mapping. Is kind of the chant that people have been having.
Yeah, and in Apple's defense, though, I guess I'm one of those one of that minority that likes the new map app.
I personally agree with you. I hear all this bad talk about it, and I'm like, you know, I'm sure this affects some people, but
the traffic is a little bit off. I mean, the traffic is not quite as clear to see for me as it was before, because before it was always a green line and now it only shows up when there's something that might be wrong, and that's a little bit harder to deal with, but it loads up so much faster being a vector graphic rather than a set of raster tiles. And sorry, just to back up for folks listening in, the difference between a vector and a raster is a vector is like saying I want a line from here to here. And a raster is saying, okay, I'm going to paint a line dot by dot from here to there. And so the time it takes for you to paint all of those dots every single time is going to take you longer than just saying, I want to, for example, have a partner hold a string. You hold one end of the string, and they move to wherever you need to go, and that's the equivalent of a vector graphic. And a raster graphic, you have to redraw every single time. And that's why, that's one of the reasons why the new map app ends up being a lot faster and less bandwidth hungry.
No, until you turn on the actual satellite image maps, and then it gets really slow.
Yeah.
Six of one half dozen. It turns that off. But so anyway, Nokia, I think, is you know, they're big on their maps, and they're partnering. I mean, they partner with Microsoft, but they're now also going to partner with Oracle to kind of overall develop their map, the strategy for maps. And I mean, clearly, it's something that a number of companies are finding to be a big game player. You know, is how to get from point A to point B, and yep. how to make it easy for people to do, and easy and safe. I mean, a lot of big pushes how to make it safe within the car. So you get a lot of the voice technology to speak your directions and your turn by turn directions and all that. So it's, I think it's still something that we're going to see a lot from. Over the next few years will be a development in mapping interfaces, you know, and how much that's used. I mean, again, Yelp is another example. Heavy reliance on maps.
Yeah. Well, to hear some people tell it, we can only get better from here. So we have Matt back. Matt from Santa Cruz. Thank you. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing all right. You had a comment about Yelp.
Yeah, I was hearing you guys talk about that, and I thought a rating system would be good, much like YouTube did. So if people gave thumbs up or thumbs down, the community could kind of control it, and the cream of the crop would rise, and the bad comments would kind of go away.
Something akin to Reddit, something akin to Dig, something like that, where the more useful a comment is, the more other people could actually comment on the comments.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent idea. Yeah, that's a very simple, elegant solution to that problem.
Yeah. I was just listening to you guys. I'm going to a wedding, so...
thanks for the call.
Be entertained.
Yeah. Take care. Bye. And so now, our phone lines are, in fact, still open. 476-2800. Or 1-800-655-5877. Alex, you and I can handle most comments and questions that are coming up. I mean, assuming that I could get you to hear the phone conversation.
Assuming I can hear the phone conversations. I'm wondering if what I hear is actually through the mic on your computer. You could probably check it on Skype. Skype setting there.
No, actually, you're posted into the board now.
Yes, but is the software using that?
Oh, yeah. Well,
mine did not switch when I plugged in my headset. I had to manually change it in the settings.
Wow. Okay.
I'm a geek. I look those sort of things up.
Oh, I see how it is. So, moving on. Okay. Aliens. What's your view on them? No. We want to have aliens know about us, but the vast distances that are between us, assuming aliens even got here to Earth, who's to say, you know, for the conspiracy theorists out there, that they weren't here thousands or millions of years ago, or will get here long after we're gone, you know, blown ourselves up from a nuclear war, or just, you know, we left the Earth and, you know, went to greener pastures, that type of thing. Well, some folks are working on a artifact to orbit the Earth, have a very loose orbit around the Earth, and it's going to be made out of gold. And Alex, can you share with us why it'll be made out of gold?
Because it's pretty.
Because it's non-reactive.
Yes, there you go.
Gold doesn't really degrade. It's why we like it for jewelry and for money, for that matter.
Yeah, it doesn't degrade. I mean, is that their primary reason, though?
The idea is that we'd have this gold-plated silicon disc that would have 100 photos on it, and it's going to be scheduled to blast off a few months from now from Kazakhstan. I actually don't know why it's going from Kazakhstan, but... and it's supposed to orbit the Earth for 5 billion years. Now, when you have information that you want to keep for a really long time, it can't be carbon. That would be a bad idea. But if you use it with gold, and as long as, you know, the sun isn't, you know, blowing up anytime sooner than we expect, or setting off some major, you know, solar flares that burn it, you know, stuff like that. As long as you have it far enough away from any heat source, that should be pretty stable for a long period of time, especially in the vacuum of space.
Didn't we do this sometime before? I seem to recall gold-plated disc we sent out for, you know, messages.
You mean on the Voyager probes?
Voyager, yes.
There never was any Voyager 6, was there?
No.
Well, it looks like we won't have any reason to go back in time and snatch some whales back into the 23rd century.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that was another time we had actually used gold plated to preserve for the longevity of what we were sending out.
Yeah.
So it's definitely not a new idea, but definitely a solid, you know, a good idea.
Yeah. Well, aren't you going to ask what kind of pictures we have on this? It's only about 100 photos.
Oh, well, I figure it was just people from Facebook saying hi, mom, and you know, sort of things.
Whole bunch of cheeseburger.
I don't know. What are we posting on there?
It's both apparently an eclectic mix of images from this article saying that they are prehistoric cave paintings all the way to photos taken of a group of people from a predator drone.
So history of the U.S., basically. I mean, of the, not the U.S., history of mankind.
Right. To know where we came from. Like to say, like, this is when we started being our species, this is what we were doing. This is our record. And then here's some stuff we're doing now.
Assuming, you know, it's ever read someday.
Right. Now, of course, we're talking about something that's supposed to be in orbit around, in loose orbit around the Earth for 5 billion years. A billion years from now, I'm thinking of that time frame, you know, the prehistoric cave paintings, they just had an NPR episode or Science Friday episode about the oldest paintings that they had found thus far. And they were just over 40,000 years old. So, you know, that would be Neanderthals.
Yeah. Well,
so that's that boundary layer. So 40,000 years from now to then, and then talk about they find this disc a billion years from now. It's kind of like you want to get a biography from someone. You're trying to get a resume, trying to figure out what someone's thing is for a senior position, someone who's in their 60s, you know, or 50s, something like that. And all you have from them are the pictures that their parents put up on their refrigerator from when they were toddlers. That time frame just doesn't seem to fit. Like, why would they care about our toddler photos a billion years from now?
Well, just to put into perspective that by time we get to that 4 billion years or 5 billion years later, if we're looking at about a 40,000-year period that we're summing up in about 100 pictures, that 40,000-year period relative to the entire 4 to 5 billion-year period that history, or at least the time that has passed since then, will pretty much represent 0.001% of the entire time span there. So 40,000 is 0.001% of 4 to 5 billion.
So in other words, the ink footprints that we put we have newborn babies put onto their little birth, not birth certificate, but the little birth notice that hospitals give, that's basically it.
Yeah.
The period of time between the time the heel print hit the page to the toe print hit the page.
Yeah, it's a tiny little speck of time. Now, granted, any single civilization that might eventually be viewing these, it's unlikely that species will have been around that entire time, whatever species it happens to be. To them, it'll be looking at some ancient alien race and artifacts that they're finding, you know, with little traces of their history and you know, it'll be weird things to them. It'd be like us, you know, looking at Mars and going, wait, was that a face? was that a marking of some some ancient recipe race?
Yeah, getting more down to earth. There's a new mission, actually, to drill to the Earth's mantle. How'd you like that segue?
From Mars to Earth.
Yeah. $1 billion to drill 6 kilometers. That's funny, 6 kilometers. Like people run that in short marathons. Or medium-sized marathons, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
No, actually, that's a pretty short marathon.
Yeah.
That's a very short marathon, now that I think of it. 10Ks are normal.
A marathon, would it?
Well, I guess not. That's your daily run, I guess, for a lot of people. It was 3.7 miles, yeah. At the same time, drilling down, you'd think that we would have drilled down further than that. Just because the Earth is far larger, the diameter of the Earth is far larger than that. But our crust is really only 6 kilometers. So we're trying to get through to the Earth's mantle. So the Earth has the crust, the mantle, the outer core, the inner core. And so far, we've only ever touched the crust, that tiny little bit at the top.
You know, I could swear we had movies that showed that we did more than that.
Yeah, we need to get get Lawrence Fishburne in on it.
Yeah. But, yeah, I don't know. It's something that I'm guessing has some serious technical difficulties and challenges going down in something that has such high amounts of pressure. You know.
Yeah, and heat.
We build tunnels, but we don't build tunnels that low.
Yeah.
You know, or that deep, rather.
Right, and it's not necessarily molten like you would expect coming out of a volcano. It's this, or actually it might be if you decompress it, but at those pressures, it may not in fact be molten. It may be just this slowly deforming solid, and that's what differentiates it from the crust. In other words, you have an apple pie, and the inside is kind of squishy, but the crust is that flaky bit at the top. So the bottom can mush around a lot more. The top is fixed, and you have to punch through it. Anyway. Moving on. Do you have any more stories, or do I need to?
No, I'm out. You've got your batch there.
Okay. So in a wonderful show of because we said so moment, Time Warner and AT&T want Kansas City to give them a subsidy, some sweetheart deal to lay out fiber optics. Now, I don't recall them doing this for many other cities in the past, but Kansas City rolled out, rolled out the welcome wagon for Google to lay out fiber to get some really fast speeds out there, and gave them incentives and waived any requirements for serving areas that wasn't necessarily demand for. But now that the Kansas City has done it for Google, AT&T and Time Warner are going, hey, wait a second, you have to give it to us too. And it's a curious turn of events where they're saying you can't just give it to one vendor, and yet they've both been notorious in many areas for being the only provider and blocking anyone else from coming in through legislation or other nefarious dealings.
And now they're crying foul.
Right. Yeah, this is what I was talking about earlier at the beginning of the show, where how much of that is we're just in the U.S. a little slow, as opposed to we're actually using too much? Like, it's always the case that, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, that the people who are using a lot of the bandwidth, the bandwidth hogs, as they're called these days pejoratively, are the normal user as time goes on, the typical user. And it just makes me wonder about, like, oh, we're using too much video. We're using too much video. And that the bandwidth hogs, as it were, right now, are just going to become normal. And it's just that infrastructure just needs to catch up.
Yes, it definitely does. I mean, we kind of touched on that earlier, is it does need to catch up.
Right, and fiber optics
are... I want fiber in my house.
Right, and fiber optics have been the way to get past what's called the last kilometer, the last mile.
Yeah.
And so in between cities and the like, we do have high-speed interconnects. We do have, you know, either fiber optic or just, you know, a large trunk of interconnects, copper interconnects that provide vast amounts of data. And for DSL, for example, the amount of data going to that junction box at the central office is tremendous. But getting it through those last two copper wires, that last mile to your house, is what slows everything down. And to some extent, the same thing with cable, although not quite as much. Coax is a lot more bandwidth available to it than that two pair. But fiber, you can have tremendous speeds over long distances. That last mile can be 10 gigabit, you know, or more, depending upon, you know, how what your connections are on the other side. Like the cable can handle all of these. It's usually the equipment on either end of it that determines how fast it's going to go. And we've been waiting for all this time, and now that Google is laying out fiber, now they're saying, okay, we know we need to lay out this fiber. Where was this fiber 10 years ago when you promised it? Okay, I'm going to get off my soapbox and quit complaining now.
Yeah, I mean, there's the you know, all the talk of Fios and, you know, whatever. What's the other one that is out there?
Yeah, Fios being fiber optic service. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think AT&T's U-verse is also supposed to be. But there's, as much as I can tell, that's really not ending up being fiber to people's home.
Right.
It's fiber to the semi-nearby area that gives it faster for the local. But to your house, it's still the same old slow connection.
Right. Lyle was getting U-verse, and he was noticing as he was hooking it up, he was mentioning this, he's like, wait a second, that just looks like two copper pair, like it always has been.
Yeah, it's not fiber to the home. It's total BS.
It's a marketing gimmick.
Yeah, I mean, granted, it is them building out their infrastructure. They are building out fiber in areas they need to extend and expand upon to support greater bandwidth overall.
Yeah, and DSL is going faster than it used to.
Yeah, so, I mean, it is improving, but it's still not there. We're still not seeing the higher speed connections into the home. You know, and quite honestly, we're also not seeing price coming down for the bandwidth, which is something that in technology you typically see happen on a much quicker or faster rate. You know, you usually see speeds go up, prices come down.
Well,
some extent, or speeds go up and prices stay stable. But we're not seeing anything. All we're seeing is prices go up and speeds staying stable.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true. Like, for example, the newer cell phones have 4G available to them. They are going faster. Unfortunately, they're being coupled with data caps so that you can fill up your data cap faster.
Sure.
Instead of taking, you know, several weeks to hit your data cap, you can now fill it within a couple of hours if you really try.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, I don't know. Personally, I want more speed. I want more.
Yeah.
And I want to pay less for it.
Well, perhaps we just need to relax.
No.
Maybe we should no. we should sit down with a beer and just, you know, relax. Like, for example, the beer that is being brewed by an Arduino and a Raspberry Pi. So a Raspberry Pi, for those who are not familiar with it, is a small ARM computer, or ARM being a type of processor. And it is only like $35. It's a a tiny computer that is useful for learning how to program or basic utilities. An Arduino is a programmable hardware, interface device. So to hook up sensors and, to have servos be generated or, you know, throw out lasers or whatnot. It can also have sensors for checking temperature, for example, and to manipulate the dials on something, as it were, or the virtual dials in some cases. And so you have this thing that people are calling BrewPi, which is an open source fermentation controller. In other words, you have your beer, it checks the temperature and makes sure that it, depending upon the time frame that's going on, that the temperature goes up or down, or that you're notified, it has can make pretty graphs to find out what is the optimum beer making for that. And so if you are crash cooling a lager, you know, you got to make sure that it cools off, but not too fast and not too slow. It got to be just the right level to keep that taste going just right. You can have it software controlled now, as long as you're willing to put in that do-it-yourselfer maker quality that we all appreciate in you. So, yeah, who would have thought? A homebrew, well, I mean, not just homebrew. You know, wow, homebrew is a double entendre there. homebrew. Yeah, okay, so.
That's something I've yet to ever try myself.
Brewing your own beer?
Yeah.
It's really big up here in the mountains. For some strange reason. And one last thing, and just but a last little tidbit as we're coming near the end of our show here, and that is 3D printers. Talked about them a lot. You put in a piece of plastic, a raw substrate, and then you're able to get whatever form you want. It's quick prototyping. Well, it turns out that one person who has a 3D printer decided, I want to create a 3D printed gun, a working firearm. Well, the manufacturer decided that this is not okay. He cited his lack of a federal firearms manufacturer's license, and they repossessed it. Saying that it will not allow their printers to be used for illegal purposes. Homemade firearms are not illegal per se, although different states have varying degrees of regulation. But it's curious to see how this will play out. That as we get 3D printers, the choice of things that we print out becomes a lot more variable. And how do you control which things are allowed and which things aren't? It goes in the same vein as if you have a scanner and like you have Photoshop, for example, if you scan in a unit of currency, like if you scan a $100 bill, it will prevent you from doing anything with that image. There are software controls on that these days.
Well, I mean, one thing I'm kind of wondering, Miles, you have the... You have these printers. I mean, first of all, was this guy actually having a prototype? What under what grounds do they have to be able to repossess something he purchased?
Well, that's a fine question. I don't know the answer to that.
That to me sounds a little odd. Unless he had some sort of prototype agreement with them, you buy it. If he buys a physical product, he owns it. They can't go into his house and repossess it because, especially the manufacturer, they don't have any right to do that. That would be the government would have to go and
now, bear in mind, you said they can't do that. They obviously can.
They don't necessarily have any legal right to do so. He might have a big countersuit against them.
We'll see. And we're coming up to the end of our show. GeekSpeak is a registered trademark, a service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence. And we thank David Lawrence for its use. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and we're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. Alex, thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you.
And helping me with my technical difficulties, which I tend to have sometimes when doing the show.
No problem. I enjoyed laughing.
Always a friend. We've been friends for years.